Last week, I announced I was going to be at the Birmingham, Alabama live show, and my appearance is not going to happen. The show is still on. That has not been canceled. Just me. I mean, I've not been canceled. I canceled myself, my appearance. I'm not going to be there. Unfortunately, my husband's work schedule wasn't coordinating with our little kids, and then when I was trying to find flights that would work, I would be paying a very large amount of money to be there for less than 24 hours. It just did not work out. I wish it did. It looked like it was going to until one more wrench got thrown into it and it just didn't make sense anymore. So I will not be in Birmingham, Alabama. However, the live show is still happening and you can still get tickets. Josh Hallmark from True Crime BS is there, Nina Instead from Already Gone and They Walk Among America, and she co-hosts Deadball as well. Then there's Jen from Our True Crime Podcast will be there, Corpus Delicti, which means Lindsay and Jen, Southern Gothic with my good friend Brandon. You guys are going to have a great time at the live show. I wish I could be there because I know it's going to be an amazing time. So with that, let's get on to the episode. A Washington mother was reported missing in October 2019. When the police began investigating, they were shocked to learn that she had been missing for a year and a half, and the people closest to her couldn't keep their stories straight. I'm Charlie, and welcome to Crime Lines. Welcome to Crime Lines. Have you ever noticed that I always say welcome to Crime Lines in the intro and then again 8 seconds later? I don't know if that's annoying or you just feel extra welcome, but I should probably try to diversify a bit in what I say. But anyway, I know this is my usual week off being the second week of the month, and I even had some listeners in the beginning of the year tell me that they were going to hold me accountable if I didn't take my scheduled breaks because they knew that I am prone to burning myself out as a workaholic. But this case is one that I just learned about and it has really weighed on me. I could shuffle things around and just release it in a couple of weeks, but I wanted to go ahead and get it out. The case I'm covering today is one that I found through Uncovered featuring it on their social media. I'll leave a link to the website in the show notes, though it is easy to remember. It's uncovered.com. This website is like the Charlie Project meets Web Sleuths. They have a huge database of unsolved cases, but also ways for the user to engage by following the cases and joining in community discussion. I am not sponsored by them. Actually, it's quite the opposite. I donated money during their crowdfunding phase when they were still building out the site and the community. When they posted on social media about this case, it really hit me. It's not always easy to see why a case will impact you, but for whatever reason, this one has been very heavy on my heart and my mind since I read about it. It is an unsolved case, and it is going cold, even though the solution is just out of reach. Maybe more publicity and a little pressure will help close that gap. Let's go ahead and get started with Courtney Holden, who was born in Washington in February 1992. Though I cannot find her tribal affiliation or information anywhere, Courtney is Native American. Since I don't know her tribe, I can't do any tribal history here, but that doesn't mean there isn't something we can talk about. And that's because when Courtney was young, she was placed into foster care. Indigenous children being taken from their homes and placed into boarding schools, missions, residential schools, and foster homes has a very long history here in North America. From the first boarding school established in 1536 in Mexico to the present day, a lot has happened, and removing Indigenous children from their homes has taken different forms. Here in the U.S., there was a major push in the 1970s to do something about it. At that time, 80% of Indigenous families had lost at least one child to foster care. In response to that, the Indian Child Welfare Act was put into place. There were a few things ICWA did. A big one was that it required child welfare authorities to first try to place a child with a family from their tribe or nation before placing them in an outside home. The placement does not have to be a kinship placement, though oftentimes that is what happened. ICWA recognizes that Native families don't always have the same familial structure as what we would call Western families. It's not always the parent doing the parenting, but it's often a network of relatives. We've seen this before, and it's one of the first things I learned from my researcher, Annie, back in 2020, when I started a concerted effort to cover more missing and murdered Indigenous women cases. An Indigenous child being raised by an aunt or a grandparent or even an older sibling doesn't mean the biological parents were unfit, unstable, or even unavailable. It's just a different structure. Of the cases we've covered, Alyssa McLemore grew up like that, as did Kaysera Stopp's Pretty Places, which actually caused some confusion in the early investigation of her case. People were unsure of who her actual legal guardian was because she had so many people contributing to her upbringing. ICWA recognized these kinship networks, and the intention was to not undermine them, even if the child's custodial parent was deemed unable to care for them. And by giving all tribal members preference in the placement of the child, ICWA respects the cultural ties. It's attempting to stop foster care from just being another version of the boarding schools or the residential schools. If a suitable home with a tribal family is not possible, then the child can be placed elsewhere. They don't live in limbo. It's just that the authorities have to try first. And both the tribe and the family relations do have a right to step in and basically hold the authorities accountable and say, you have to try harder. I'm not going to sit here and say that ICWA is a perfect piece of legislation and that it always goes smoothly and the best parent for the child is always found. How do you perfectly legislate the manner in which you take a child from their home? We will never have a perfect system to do that because the goal is to find the least damaging way to inflict trauma, but nothing is ever going to stop that from being trauma. The reason I bring up ICWA isn't because it was entirely relevant in Courtney's story. Her situation hasn't been made public enough to judge that. But I wanted to mention it because it's a current event. It was challenged in the Supreme Court last November. The argument made at the base level is that ICWA is racially discriminatory against Indigenous children under the 14th Amendment by making race a factor in where they are placed and who can adopt them. The issue with that, that will have widespread effects beyond the Indian Child Welfare Act, is the argument that the act is in place because Indigenous people are a race and not a political group. And this matters because the sovereignty of federally recognized tribes is a political matter, just like the sovereignty of the United States is. So, is being an enrolled member of a recognized tribe a racial marker or a political one? That's a big thing to have the Supreme Court vote on. I'm interested to see if they sidestep that issue or tackle it head on. I can't see how they can approach this without defining that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. That case is still, as of this recording, being decided, and a decision should be made before summer. It appears to me that Courtney Holden was not placed with a member of her tribe because the Justice for Native People website has her tribal information listed as unknown. And if her adoptive family was Native, they would probably know that information. Courtney was placed in the home of Judy Holden, who had a number of foster children over the years. She didn't adopt all of them, but she did adopt Courtney, though this was not the forever family that any child would have dreamed to be a part of. According to another foster child who had been in the home, the family was abusive to the children. He believed the Holdens took children in for the money. That stereotype, that people get into foster care for the money, can be very hurtful. I've yet to personally meet a foster parent who didn't spend more per month on clothes and food and toys and activities and field trips than they brought in. But from what Courtney's foster brother Jensen told KHQ News in early 2020, it doesn't sound like that was the case with the Holdens. He remembered living in an unstable home where he was in absolute fear of the Holden family. His brother, who was placed with him, was a particular target of Judy Holden's son, Joshua, who was frequently violent. Eventually, Jensen left the Holden's home when his brother fought back and actually stabbed a member of the family. This alerted Jensen's biological family to what was going on, and when he was 12, his sisters were able to get him out of Judy Holden's care, but only after he spent his formative years there being abused. When he left, Courtney, who, like I said, had been adopted, was left in the home. The main abuser in the home, according to Jensen, was not Judy, but rather her son Joshua. Joshua was about 10 to 15 years older than most of the foster children, and he was about 13 years older than Courtney. At some point, Joshua did move out of the home. Courtney started dating a man named Michael, and in 2012, when she was 20 years old, she gave birth to a son who we will call Stephen. That is not his name, but he is a minor, and I do not like using children's names if I can avoid it. Courtney still lived with her adoptive family at this point, as her relationship with Michael did not last long. Then in 2014, Joshua Holden, who was in his mid-30s by that point, moved back in with his mother Judy in her Spokane, Washington home. And according to neighbors, he almost immediately added several security cameras outside their home. The neighbors had heard that Joshua had been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, which I'm not sure is true, but it is what the neighbors had heard. So they thought the cameras were just some type of hypervigilance thing. Courtney continued to live in the home with her son Stephen, Joshua, and Judy, though there were no more foster children at this point as Judy was older and entering her 70s. Then in late 2017, early 2018, Stephen's father, Michael, stopped enforcing the parenting plan, which gave him regular visits. He was dealing with some personal issues, including substance abuse and a serious emergency involving another family member. So for about a year and a half to 2 years, he didn't see or talk to Courtney at all. But then in mid-2019, Michael was in a much better place in his life, and he wanted to reestablish contact with Stephen. His girlfriend at the time, Autumn, encouraged this and even tried to call Courtney for him when he couldn't reach her. She knew Courtney and she knew her to be a good and reasonable person. When Autumn also couldn't reach Courtney, she became concerned. On August 5th, 2019, she called Crime Check, which is Spokane County's non-emergency police number. She knew this wasn't a 911 emergency, but she explained that it had been over a year and a half since she had heard from or seen Courtney, and she basically was asking for a welfare check. The next day, Michael decided to call as well, but rather than calling about Courtney, he called about his son, explaining that he had an existing parenting plan that he was attempting to restart. The last place he knew his son had been living was with Judy Holden. So on October 8th, the police went out to Judy's home to do a welfare check. Joshua opened the door and said that Courtney and her son had moved out. She took the little boy a while ago and left with a boyfriend whose name he didn't know. Joshua did not allow the police in, and he was not willing to answer more questions. Crime Check then, that same day, got a call from a woman who identified herself as Courtney and said that she was perfectly fine. But the police were not actually convinced that this woman was Courtney, so they categorized her and Stephen as missing persons. They reached out to other family and friends to see if anyone had seen Courtney. On October 9th, they reached Courtney's brother, Reuben, and his girlfriend, who was also named Courtney. And she had a lot to say to the police. She and Ruben had not seen Courtney in at least 18 months, but they had seen Stephen every single time they were at Judy's house visiting. In fact, Courtney, the sister-in-law, was told that she had to start using a different name when she was in the house. Joshua said he didn't want the use of the name Courtney to make Stephen miss his mom too much or to think about her leaving him, because according to Judy, Courtney had run off with a boyfriend, leaving her son behind. Courtney, the sister-in-law, didn't think that sounded right. Courtney was a very attentive mother who did pretty much nothing except take care of her son. Even though it sounded strange that Courtney would have abandoned her son like that, people do things that are out of character sometimes. So she didn't think to mention Courtney running off to anyone else, and she certainly didn't notify the police. But now that the police were calling her, she was able to get these concerns off her chest. Though Courtney's brother and his girlfriend didn't have any specific information about where Courtney was, this interview did show something very important. Joshua Holden had been asked about Courtney and Stephen by the police exactly one time. And in the few sentences he spoke to the police, he lied. He lied when he said Courtney, wherever she went, took her son with her. The most suspicious thing you can do to the police is lie to them. This case was assigned to the Major Crimes Unit.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros. Two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude. Stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
The day after speaking to the other Courtney, the detectives went back to Judy's home to essentially confront her and Joshua about what they now knew. Judy was willing to talk to them, but outside. Judy told them that Courtney had actually been home when the police came the first time, but she had since left with her son, and now Judy didn't know where she or Stephen went for real. So now the police were getting story number two, and they were not buying it. They asked Judy for her phone number in case they needed to reach back out, and she went inside the house to get it for them. When she did, she closed and deadbolted the door behind her. It was a clear sign she was not interested in them seeing the inside of her house, which only made the police more persistent about getting in there. When she came back outside, they managed to convince her to consent to letting them look around. She was observed as being nervous the entire time they were in the house, trying to keep all of the officers in her line of sight. She was cooperating, but reluctantly so. The police found the house messy with pretty much every surface piled with clutter. Judy allowed them to look in Courtney's room, which they also found to be a mess. But they noticed that her bed was bare. No sheets, blankets, or even a pillow. And it didn't look like anyone had actually slept in that room. They then asked Judy if they could look around for Courtney's son, Stephen, or at least peek in his room. Judy said absolutely not, and in fact, that was going to be the end of the search. She withdrew her consent, and the police left. They decided to go ahead and do a knock and talk with the neighbors to see if they could get more information, and these neighbors had a lot to say. For one thing, the neighbors did confirm that Stephen had been at the house in the time that Courtney was not. In fact, one neighbor saw him leave the house that very day with Josh, Judy, and another of the Holden sisters. The investigators also heard a lot about what may have been going on in the Holden home over the years. It wasn't just from neighbors, but family as well, who painted a picture that led me to the impression that Courtney had been essentially a prisoner in the home. Allegedly, of course. These accusations have not been proven in court, though based on what has been presented, these stories have come from multiple witnesses. Neighbors and family members, and like I said, former foster kids, characterized 40-year-old Joshua Holden as a violent and abusive man who didn't just abuse the younger kids in the home, but also his 74-year-old mother, Judy. According to them, she seemed absolutely terrified of him, as did Courtney. One neighbor said one time they saw bruises on Courtney and asked her about them, and she said they were from Joshua. In spite of people's suspicions of abuse occurring in the home, the police had never been called, and possibly that's because people tend to look the other way when all of the people involved are adults. Too often people are thinking, well, they're adults, they have free will, if they want to stay, they stay, if they want to go, they go. So it gets put in the category of not being our business. But Courtney wasn't just any adult who was staying in an abusive home. Though she was 26 at the time she went missing, she had grown up in this house. She was taught that this was normal. It makes me think a little bit of J.C. Dugard, who was kidnapped at the age of 11 and held captive for 18 years. She had been so terrorized and programmed to comply to her captor's demands that she didn't alert people to her true identity even when she had the opportunity as a legal adult. Not to mention that she had children in that home, like Courtney did. And by leveraging children, it's not hard to get a parent to comply. Now, Courtney had not been kidnapped by Joshua Holden or Judy Holden, but I can see parallels in the dynamic if the numerous accusations of abuse are true. According to family members, Courtney's nickname in the house was Cindy, short for Cinderella, as Judy and Joshua would poke fun at how they made her do everything. And to diminish any authority she had in the home even more, they started having her son called Joshua Daddy, even though he was the uncle, and Judy Mom, even though she was the grandmother. Family members heard Stephen use these terms even in front of Courtney, and he'd often call her by her first name. They also started calling Stephen Forrest, which is not his legal name, not the name Courtney and Michael gave him, and not the name Courtney wanted him to be called. Some people even heard Joshua say that Stephen was his son, which he wasn't. Courtney, while in the home, was forbidden from having her own cell phone, even as an adult, and she seemed to rarely leave the house without a family member with her. Occasionally, she would be seen outside the house doing yard work and would have a chance to talk to a neighbor over the fence. She opened up a little, telling this neighbor about how she couldn't leave the house without Josh's permission, and she knew she couldn't sneak out while he was gone because he had all the cameras set up. Courtney had a Facebook account at one point, and she would use it to message a friend. One day, she sent a message that said, "I gotta go, I gotta go, Josh is coming." And that was the last message she ever sent. It seems once Joshua found out about the account, she lost access to it. Neighbors said eventually they noticed Courtney only came out to do yard work in the evenings when it was getting dark, and she was speaking to people less and less. But they would hear Joshua, who was yelling at her and her son. The neighbor said that at some point in 2018, they noticed that Courtney wasn't out of the house ever. When people would ask Judy about where she went, they'd usually get the same stories everyone else did. She had run off with a boyfriend or a fiancé. Sometimes they would even get the added detail that this man was a long-haul trucker, so that maybe would explain the long absence or why she decided she had to leave her son behind. Occasionally, if someone would call and ask for Courtney, Judy or Joshua would just say she was home, but unable to take the call at that moment. With how isolated Courtney had become, it went on like that for, as far as the investigators could tell, 14 to 18 months until Stephen's father and stepmother showed up trying to see him. The investigators were trying to pinpoint exactly when Courtney was last seen by someone other than the Holdens, who had proven themselves to be unreliable narrators. Because Courtney didn't have a cell phone or social media, those usual avenues for tracking someone were a no-go. The police did find that Courtney's bank account had been accessed right up to the day the police first went to the Holden house to look for her, and her food stamps were used that day as well. In pulling CCTV, they saw that $600 was withdrawn from Courtney's bank account by Judy and Joshua. And then it was Judy and Joshua and Stephen who were at their grocery store using the food stamps. The investigators found that Courtney had a doctor's appointment back in October 2017. She had a prescription she refilled every 1 to 2 months, and the last time that was filled was July 2018. Though some sources say that April was actually the last time they could confirm 100% that Courtney was alive. That said, they did have a neighbor who said they saw Courtney in what they remembered to be the summer of 2018, very likely in August. On this day, the neighbor said Courtney stormed out of the house carrying a large duffel bag. Judy was right on her heels, yelling at her to get back in the house. Courtney said, "I'm not staying here anymore." Then Joshua came out, picked Courtney up, and physically carried her back into the house. Courtney could have hardly fought him off. He stood over 6 feet tall, he was at least 300 pounds, and she was practically half his size. Another neighbor reported that around the same time, they saw Joshua digging in the backyard after dark using spotlights. Joshua said he was installing a swing set, but it seemed odd to the neighbor that he was waiting until the middle of the night to do the work. But Joshua was an odd guy, so they just kind of brushed it off. I have to imagine, at this point, the police strongly suspected something terrible had happened to Courtney. The only evidence they had that she was alive was the woman who called in and claimed to be Courtney. But through more interviews, they learned that it was actually Judy's daughter who made that call. The reason she agreed to pose as her sister to the police has not been made public. The police also learned in this investigation that Joshua's reputation for being violent and erratic was backed up with his arrest record. He had arrests for unlawful imprisonment, rape, and domestic violence. He was also a suspect in a second rape, though it seems his only conviction was for burglary. The rape case Joshua had been arrested on was a strong case, and they were in the process of testing evidence pending trial when the victim stopped cooperating with the state. Without her testimony, they didn't have enough to see it through, and the charge was dropped. Obviously, there was a lot of concern for Courtney, but also for her son. Thanks to the CCTV footage, they knew he was alive at least as of early October 2019. But how long would he be safe? Plus, he had a father who wanted contact and had visitation rights. The police needed eyes on the little boy. On October 24th, 2019, with all of this evidence, the investigators were able to get a search warrant for the Holden home. When they arrived at the house, Judy, Joshua, Stephen, and their six pets were gone. Also gone was the recording device from Joshua's many security cameras. While a partial list of items found in the home on this search has been released, there isn't a lot of context or details given. They found computers and 18 cell phones, all that needed to be digitally searched. They also found handwritten blackmail notes, with nothing I saw saying who was doing the blackmailing, who the target was, or what the blackmail material had to do with. They also found Courtney's journal. They brought in a cadaver dog who didn't pick up anything. The police believed Courtney was likely dead, and they also believed that their persons of interest who would have the most information about this were on the run. Family members had told the police that they heard both Joshua and Judy say that they knew ways to evade the police, and Joshua even bragged about how easy it would be for him to hide a body. None of this boded well for the investigation. However, a month after the search of the house, a neighbor called the police to say that someone was at the Holden's home in that moment. The officers immediately zipped on over there to find Judy's son-in-law. He said that he and his wife, Judy's daughter, had come up from Texas to check on the house. This was not the same daughter who had pretended to be Courtney on the phone. The son-in-law said that Judy was on a retirement road trip with Joshua, and he hadn't seen Courtney in 2 years. When asked about Stephen, he said that Stephen was with Judy and Joshua. But then his wife walked up and said that, no, Stephen was actually with Courtney, who had taken him when she left. And she said she had no idea how to get in touch with her mother at that point. But then the police learned that Joshua and Judy's Washington phone lines were deactivated the same day the pair got new phone numbers with Texas area codes. So Joshua and Judy wanted Texas phones, and here was Judy's daughter and son-in-law who happened to live in Texas, and they were giving conflicting stories. Well, this gave the police an idea of where Judy and Joshua and possibly Stephen went. And they were correct. The police learned that Judy, Joshua, and thankfully Stephen had shown up at her daughter's house in Plano, Texas on November 26th with all of their things. On December 19th, 2019, the police moved in and arrested Joshua and Judy Holden. While they believe the mother and son knew something about Courtney's disappearance and had lied and lied and lied to cover it up, they didn't have the evidence they needed to press charges in that case. The search of the Spokane house and the Texas home gave nothing definitive, and neither did the search of an RV in Oklahoma, where Judy, Joshua, and Stephen, under assumed names, had spent the time between Washington and Texas. So the two were arrested instead on charges of identity theft for using Courtney's bank account, and they were also charged with custodial interference for taking Stephen. Stephen was then put into the care of Child Services until his father, Michael, could get to Texas to pick him up and take custody. Judy, 74 years old, and Joshua, 40, refused to speak to the police, and they also initially refused to waive their extradition hearing, causing the authorities to have to jump through some additional hoops to get them back to Spokane to face the charges. Their attorney told the Spokane Review that Courtney left Stephen in Judy and Joshua's care. So they had him with the permission of the custodial parent. He said he planned to locate Courtney to prove she was alive and well, and that would be used in their defense. That never happened. Joshua Holden pleaded guilty to custodial interference and criminal mischief. Judy pleaded out to just custodial interference. Both Joshua and Judy have since been released, and Courtney Holden remains missing. This investigation was marked with a lot of people having pieces to the puzzle of Courtney's life, and it made for a dark picture. It sounds like Judy and Joshua asked other family members to help them after the investigation started, first having one daughter pretend to be Courtney on the phone, and then have another provide them with housing 1,800 miles away. Perhaps someone along the way was given more information about exactly what happened with Courtney. And if you are that person, it is time to come forward. Courtney was given no breaks in life thus far. At least give her son some answers. If you have any information relating to the disappearance of Courtney Holden, contact the Spokane Police Department at 509-755-2489. This number will be in the show notes. Thank you for listening. You can find Crimelines on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and occasionally TikTok. Crimelines is on Patreon, where I offer early and ad-free episodes, as well as bonus content. Visit patreon.com/crimelines. If you want to buy me a coffee, the official drink of Crimelines, you can give a one-time donation at basementfortproductions.com/support. And if you need a palate cleanser after listening to heavier true crime shows, check out Rusty Hinges, an allegedly funny history, mystery, and true crime show that I co-created and write for.